Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show alive and kicking at newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, Caoimhe Dufrain sets a journaling challenge, Janine Van Someren, performance expert, on her book The Wellbeing Advantage, and Claire Mansfield on why she and her husband have taken their fertility journey experience of twins by egg donation and set up a support service for people on a similar path. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I had to admit I had to bring myself back from the brink there. It took me a while to recalibrate. As they say, you are only as happy as your least happy child. But we are all fine. And in the grand scheme of things, it was really nothing too sinister. But I really did have to dig deep to come back from emotions, overthinking and spiralling. But I am back on an even keel for now. I spoke about what helped me last week, the usual, getting outside, talking to others, breath work, early nights. But you know what else helped? Getting out of the house and out of my own head. I had two lovely invites over the last week. One was a skin brand event in town with an overnight hotel stay, and the other a planned night away with two of my best pals. Now, I wasn't by any stretch dreading going to these, but you know when there's a lot going on, you sometimes wonder, will you be able for it? Do you have the social battery? And obviously, because there was stuff going on, I felt like I wanted to be around at home. The best thing I did was get the hell out and have a bit of crack. So my message to you is to say yes to something this week. I know it's a fine line between pushing yourself to exhaustion and knowing when you need a nudge to just follow through and get yourself out and about and do something. But you'll know what's best for you. And I feel all the better for getting out and doing stuff this week. You can email the show aliveandkicking at newstalk.com. Now, as with lots of health and wellness endeavours, sometimes, even when we know it'll be good for us, we can resist things. Case in point for me is journaling. Much as I love writing, I just can't seem to make it a regular practice. Caoimhe Dufrain came on the show a while back to talk about vision boarding, and she is running an online journaling club that starts tomorrow night, and she joins me in studio now. Caoimhe, you're very welcome.
Thank you for having me back.
Is it common for people to resist journaling?
Absolutely. For many reasons. One reason is a simple block. What am I going to write? It just might feel strange to put pen to paper, to think about what's going on in my head. Or sometimes people just don't want to actually know what's going on in their head because it's too scary or overwhelming to unpick.
And do you think it has anything to do with the fact that we're on our phones a lot more now? So, like, I would rarely have a pen and paper in my orbit. The odd shopping list or to-do list, I've scraps of paper all over the place. But, you know, to have a book that's dedicated to you writing about yourself is quite alien to many.
It is, especially now with the phones. And with the phones, we kind of use it as a distraction, right? As a way to get away from what we're actually thinking about. And sometimes even as a reward or a way to just escape.
So what is the definition of journaling? Why is it good for us?
So there's lots of different ways to journal, right? For me, journaling, if you're to think about it in the context of life design, so you're designing your life, how you want it to be and who you want to be and how you want to show up. Journaling is a really powerful tool to help you figure out what matters to me. What does success look like going forward? So less, dear diary, this is what happened, and more, what do I want today to look like? How do I want to show up today? What relationships are bringing me energy and what ones are draining me? It's a really great way to help you create hyper self-awareness, I would say. So when I journal, I would journal daily-ish, right? So it's kind of four-ish times a week. And I start to get real-time insights into my behaviour, say when I'm with the kids. So if I'm freaking out at the kids, I start to get insights, oh, actually, it's not really on the kids. It's just that I'm feeling anxious about something. And it's because I've built up that journaling muscle that I'm that aware of what's going on in my head.
So is there a right or a wrong way to journal?
I would argue there's no wrong way to do anything. I would say that there's many ways to journal. And there's many techniques. So when I journal, I would use freeform journaling, right? Which is a fancy way of saying putting pen to paper and letting the pen flow. I'm not thinking about my grammar. I'm not thinking about my spelling. I'm just getting my thoughts out, right? I'd also use mind maps. So I might put one of my values into a mind map. So for example, community is one of my big values. And I put it into the center of the page and I put arrows coming out of that. And I'll think about, okay, where am I showing up with lots of community? Where am I feeding into my community? So there's lots of different types of journaling.
Yeah. And if you have ideas, you're like, do you know what? I must knock into that neighbor. I must catch up with that friend. I must volunteer down at the center. Life just goes on without us, and we can have all the best of intentions and weeks turn to months and then, you know, you haven't got it done. Whereas I suppose when you commit something to paper like that, does it help you to realise it a little bit and bring it into action a little bit more?
Absolutely. It just makes you more intentional about it. It brings you, it focuses you more on it. And then you see the opportunity to call into your neighbour because you have a spare half an hour that you might have otherwise spent on the phone. But now because you've journaled, actually, I'd love to call into that neighbour, just check in on them. And then you're like, oh, I've got this half an hour. I'm going to go in and do it. So you've kind of primed your brain to see the time to do that.
So you are starting an online course. It's running over several weeks, starting tomorrow, Monday evening. So how is that going to work?
So it's going to be 30 minutes on Monday evenings. You can log on from the comfort of your bed if you want, right? There'll be no cameras on. It'll be a simple check-in with how are you doing through journaling, right? So you won't be sharing. And then every week there'll be new themes and new prompts to help you reconnect with yourself and step away from the noise and the rush and just come back to home.
So can you give an example of some of the prompts?
Yeah, so some prompts, one of the weeks we'll be focusing on the roles we play in life. So for example, maybe you, Claire, I'm going to assume some of the roles, mother, communicator, wife, like those different roles, right? We play maybe 6 to 10 roles. And you will look at those with through the lens of what's bringing me energy, what isn't. How can I manage this relationship or this role that I'm playing more intentionally?
And this is something you have really dedicated your life to. I mentioned the vision boarding that you came on and spoke about in the show. And it's all about giving people space to figure out what's working in their life, what isn't, and what are tweaks they can make to get closer towards what they want. And to me, that is the essence of wellness, checking in with ourselves. And quite often, we don't give ourselves time. And to really formalize it with either pen and paper or boards and, you know, sticky notes and whatever else you put on your vision board, it just helps you solidify it. What's some of the feedback you get from people or the insights that they get?
So this is my third time doing the journaling club. And a previous journaling club member told me that she started meeting her friends more as a result of doing the club. She has 2 smallies at home, a 3 and a 1-year-old, and she just hadn't made the space because, you know, you get caught up in the rush, right? And she was like, God, I really miss the fun I have with that group of friends. So she started meeting them more. Another person said that it was a gorgeous part of their weekly ritual just to have that space for them to reconnect. It's not even making drastic changes. It's just somebody wrote in a workshop the other day. It was like coming back home. It was like finding themselves again.
Well, I'm looking forward to giving it a go. You have kindly invited me on and sent me a lovely purple journal because I always say we don't have to do all wellness endeavours. If you don't like getting in the sea, you don't have to, you know, no matter how much you hear about cold water immersion. Same with journaling. I might try it on and go, do you know what? That's not for me. But what I like is to sit and meditate or whatever it is for different people. But I won't know until I try it properly. So I'm going to give it a go and I'll let people know how I'm getting on. But, you know, I can't see any harm in it.
I love that. And you're so right. There's a million wellness tools out there, right? And it doesn't matter what ones you use. Just try out one or two of them and see if it works or not. And if it doesn't work, great, maybe journal about why it didn't work and then move forward with more information on what might work better for you in future.
Well, I'd love to hear people's thoughts on journaling. Is it something that you do regularly? What do you get out of it? Or like me, are you averse to the whole thing? I'd love to hear why. aliveandkicking@newstalk.com is the email address that is always open to you. And if you want to find out more about this workshop and others that Caoimhe runs, you can go to dufresne.com/workshops. Caoimhe Dufresne, thank you so much, and I'll see you online tomorrow night.
Thanks very much, Claire.
Coming up after the break, Claire Mansfield on her egg donation pathway to parenthood.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, I met Claire Mansfield last year at the Future Fertility Show in Dublin. And even though I met lots of amazing people that weekend and interviewed a host of experts, she really stood out in my mind. You'll hear why in a moment. She has a very vivacious energy, which she brings to a somewhat taboo topic, egg donation. And Claire joins me in studio now. Claire, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Claire. It's great to be here. We both said we wanted to make this happen and we made it happen.
Yes, and I'm delighted. Yeah. Are you okay with me describing you as having a vivacious energy?
That sounds great. Thank you. Likewise, right back at you.
No, you do. And, you know, it's a taboo topic and yeah, I don't really understand. Yeah. Although, you know, lately, even anecdotally, I met somebody who had just had a baby and I said, you know, how are you getting on? And he's 6 months old and, you know, we're describing the chaos and the joy. And she said, but, I'm delighted that I have my husband. I have a friend who, you know, went it alone through donation and, you know, she can be struggling at times. And it's just coming into the parlance way, way more. It's way more common than we think, isn't it?
And that's what we want and that's what we need. And that's why you and I have these conversations, is to bring in that awareness. And it's an advocacy still. It's not just on the street. You know, IVF is probably 10 years. We were on this journey 10 years ago. IVF was kind of becoming accepted. It was something you knew people did. When I was pregnant on twins, I was asked, was it IVF? So it was that much in people's, vocabulary, that this was an option. Egg donation is probably only getting to that stage now, if even, because it's just not something that's talked about. And there are lots more, you know, obviously fertility rate is increasing and people are struggling more and more people will be affected by, you know, delayed fertility or delayed parenthood. And we have all the stars getting pregnant in their 40s and, you know, and they don't have to advocate for egg donation. It's still it's their private family struggle. But I suppose I feel, for me, the fact that I'm so grateful and so open and so honest. And if you say vivacious, like for me, this is just a love story. And this is how it came for us. Flowering became a story I wrote for my children of their origins and of their path to parenthood. And in that, I just wanted to be open for everyone and all paths to parenthood, you know, because our gay couples can now have parenthood choices. You know, there's lots has changed in this 10 years as well for lots of different couples. And we need to speak up. We need to speak out and create tolerance and, you know, move that judgment piece away so that we can all share our story.
Yeah, well, I'm delighted to have you on this show to share your story. So yourself and your husband, Shane, the usual, decided let's have a baby. It proved to be more complicated than you had expected.
Yeah.
When did egg donation become part of the discussion?
So our journey was a 4-year journey of not getting pregnant every month. I, like yourself, I'm into wellness and holistic lives and quite spiritual as well by nature. So IVF wasn't in my vocabulary. I very much believed that I would get pregnant. It would happen this month. I was in denial. I was like feeling baby kicks. You know, there's people like feel themselves pregnant. And I was extremely positive. And my three younger sisters were all getting pregnant easily and naturally. And my mom had 6 kids. So it just didn't really enter my head that infertility was going to be a problem. After 4 years, anyone who isn't getting pregnant is already in some kind of a grief. You know, a grief that hasn't worked out, a grief you're not getting pregnant, a grief that everyone else is. And then the grief that you're afraid of, like what will a result actually bring? So Shane is a medical scientist, quite my opposite. So he was quite eager to maybe get a checkup. Eventually we went in and had our workups done, you know, some bloods, talked a bit about your cycle. I was age 38 at the time, and it was pretty much evident from the beginning for our consultant when she was putting egg donor pamphlets in my file against my judgment, that things weren't looking great. So the biggest, I suppose, blow emotionally and scientifically was this AMH test. So it measures your egg count or your egg reserve. So mine was, and I've said this to you before, it was like 0.01 or 0.1. I haven't looked back to see. There was zero, so there was a point, and there was one, and they had written down beside it negligible, underlined. And that was just so shocking. Like, we weren't expecting that.
What age were you, Claire?
So that was 38. And so that measurement equates to a 50-year-old kind of menopausal woman. Not even me now. It should be me still in 3 years' time, you know. So that was extremely shocking. When I actually got the result, I wasn't with Shane. The doctor was looking over my shoulder for the rock of sense because I was always very emotional about this. I really wanted babies. Yeah, it was really, really tough, really, really tough to hear. And I had vocalised to Shane that I didn't believe in IVF and I wouldn't do IVF. So he was afraid of what results would bring and if I was against IVF that much. So luckily, I'm quite fluid in my beliefs and I was offered IVF and took that choice immediately, of course.
And as we're on the advocacy piece, I really think language is very important. And for someone to read those noughts and an underlined negligible, yeah, I think that could be delivered in a much better way.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of messaging as well around who is responsible for this infertility, whereas it, you know, it just is what it is to be glib about it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And often it is seen as a female issue. Now, I know it came down to that egg count,
yeah,
but often it is just about the couple's compatibility. It yes. can be all kinds of things. So we're always looking for reasons and blame, and all of that should be taken out of it. But understandably, it's a very difficult time. It's very challenging. And as you said, there's a grief to deciding you want to get pregnant, peeing on a stick and saying it's happened and telling everybody. To know it's not going to be that path is hard to get your head around. So was egg donation part of your original IVF journey?
No. So we did one round of IVF to see would we get an egg or two. Like there was, as she said, it wasn't zero yet. It was quite straightforward once that psychological, emotional hurdle was overcome. So we were in Kilkenny at the time, so we used a clinic in Kilkenny for local purposes. And they had a fantastic egg donation coordinator. And then we travelled to a clinic in Prague in the Czech Republic. And again, they had a fabulous egg donation coordinator. So we pretty much were minded very much then. You were in, everything was fairly straightforward. Our consultant had said, once you make the choice to go this donor egg route, it's actually easier on the woman, that process. Like you're not in a cycle with stims. It's a different kind of cycle. You're more about opening to receive this egg. One thing my mum had said, and she meant it in a very good way, and people often think this themselves, and it was like, if you go this donor egg route, be 100% sure this is what you want. This is your choice. And I said to Shane, oh, I'm not sure. It's not 100%.
Are we ever 100% on anything?
So I spoke to someone that had been through the journey and she just said, no, Claire. She said, you're as far as, she, like my vivacious personality, she said, you're so positive about this. She said, you're like 90% there already and you're only going into it. She said, you don't have to. If you're most of the way there, none of us chose not to get pregnant straight away. None of us chose to have to go through IVF. And certainly none of us chose then to do this egg donor route. It's just, this is our path. So she said, if you're most of the way there, at some point, it'll click. You know, it could be when you have your pregnancy, a positive result. It could be down the line, X amount of weeks, which is when she told me she was pregnant. It could be when you hold your baby or you feed the baby, you know. For me, it was, and I often tell ladies, there's all these add-ons in IVF. And one of ours was an embryoscope. So it's like a camera looking at the embryo. And I felt we were buying that extra thing for Shane because he would understand cell division and the embryo grows into a blastocyst. So we had that add-on, which was maybe 500 euros at the time. And everything's an added expense. But actually, I tell every single lady in my position to get that because the minute I saw them, like our babies in a ball cell on a plate multiplying, I was like, they're the babies and they were ours and they were mine straight away. So, you know, everyone is going to be different.
There's lots of different moments. It doesn't have to be right now, which I think is a really important point. Yeah. So is it the same as getting sperm donation? Are you looking through?
No, you get much less choice, or we did. And I think in the States it's quite different, but it's also highly expensive over there. So we fill out a form and you choose your eye colour, your hair colour, your kind of height and waist, physicality. You might talk a little bit about hobbies. Not that much. You don't get much choice. And one of the things I didn't like is they came back with a donor that I just did not feel was the fit for our family. So she had brown eyes and we are all very light blue-eyed people in my family. So I just said it. And then you're quite emotional as well. So you're not always like your, you know, clear self. But I really felt this wasn't the fit. So I just advocated with the clinic and I said, look, it has to be blue eyes. Like I didn't want to be everywhere I went. Where'd brown eyes go? And we're also nosy in Ireland. Everyone wants to have a look and to figure out where the count came from. And I just didn't want that conversation always. So they needed to be blue eyes. And so I just advocated. We had to wait a little bit and they found a donor. And the donor was there, like you just passed because you can't speak the language. But she was like a younger, lighter, prettier version of me. And she was a teacher as well. And she had those light eyes. And I just love that I even energetically picked the right choice for our family, if that makes sense.
So you went on to be pregnant and give birth to two twin girls. Yes. How did that feel?
Yeah, like I always say, Zoe was our firstborn and I always tell her this and she loves it. She rolls her eyes now because she's 9. And I say, oh, and then you were born and I burst into tears off and they were like, joy. And we did. We couldn't, like Shane, as a scientist, he just never seemed to get excited. Like I was always excited. Even the minute the baby went in, I was like, the baby's there, we're technically pregnant, you know. And then we were pregnant and then we were pregnant with twins and everything was good. And he was just always pragmatic and cautious because, again, I suppose from the medical science side, they always see what goes wrong. They don't see, they're not down in the baby ward hugging babies. They're, you know, seeing the other side of medicine. So he was, until that moment, cautious. And then they came and that was his moment of finally emotion and just joy. It was amazing. Yeah.
And then, which is a really important part of your story, in the pandemic, you had a spontaneous, I love that word, a spontaneous pregnancy without assistance, apart from Shane.
Yeah. No.
How did that feel?
It was shocking. It really was shocking because we were not trying to have a baby and I'm not trying to minimize it. I'm just, we weren't. We had gone back to a clinic in Prague to see if the donor would donate again because we thought our girls were the like most perfect girls you could ever get and we wanted more of those. So we still knew we wanted to extend our family and have more children. We were planning another set of twins and then we'd be sorted. And the donor wasn't donating anymore. So we were quite disappointed about that. But we said we'd rejig things and we'd kind of go again the following year. So we were getting ourselves very fit and healthy because a twin pregnancy is no joke. And we knew how important it was for him to have his DNA right for the sperm side. So we were just being healthy and well as parents of twin girls. And then, yeah, we were very surprised.
And you had another beautiful little girl. Something that really struck me both times on the stage of the Future Fertility Show, you really want to impress upon people that there is no difference in how you feel about your twin girls born by egg donation and your third daughter born from your own egg. Yeah. It's the same. The love is the same because that is an understandable worry for people.
Yeah, I wish I knew. And like, we're all here for different reasons. We're here for our personal journey in the world where we create our family and we learn lessons to our lives in that family dynamic. I also believe we're here on a bigger purpose and we're all here with some kind of a little mission to do. And for mine, flowering is a mission. It really comes from deep within me to share what I learned on my journey and help others. So when I look at it from that viewpoint, I'm like, Isabella came to show me there's no difference and to speak again, advocate and create awareness about that, because that is the biggest. And usually it's always the opposite, not always, but it's often, very often, the opposite way around. You have your first or your second child naturally, and then age is still there as a factor. So it's maybe that they're, you know, late 30s, early 40s, still haven't finished your family, and they know that and want to have them, and this age piece comes into play, or the AMH has dropped and egg donation suddenly becomes an option. And it seems to be a more difficult option for these ladies because they have a baby and know what that love is like, a naturally conceived. They call it own egg and donor egg. And I go like this with my fingers because it makes no sense now, but it is how I felt. And I felt that loss of my godchild looks quite like me, and she was that mini me. And I was like, I won't have that. And I do have that now. And I was told by my family at the weekend, oh, Isabella's a mini you. And that means way more now. But also I still have my mini me. Like, we're all, it just, like, I try to impress upon people, I promise you, you're going to love your baby the same. You grow them. You love them so much. You're so grateful that you went to such lengths. Like, it's such an extended love story. Like, what you had to do to have those babies.
And when you mentioned flowering, that's floweringfertilitysupport.com. It started off as a story you wanted to tell your twin girls about how they came into the world.
Yeah.
But now it's an organisation that you and your husband Shane run to support other couples and individuals on an infertility journey.
Yeah, it started, it started organically with a story for our children, a story about two flowers in a garden falling in love. And the following day, when we were going to all the internet cafes to look at our embryoscope to see the babies, I saw across the wall flowering in English over in Czech Republic. And I said, that's the name of the story. And it was strange. And I looked up the definition, and flowering means to reproduce, but it also means to reach one's optimum stage of development. So we became, somewhere along the line, we were helping people in the fertility journey with one-to-ones or programs. We have our next program starting tonight, the flowering program. So it's 8 weeks of support with different experts. Then we started into, we have podcasts, we have an app coming out. It's all, and now we're going digital. But it's been growing and growing, and the market is massive. And I was on all these accelerator courses for women in innovation. So ultimately, what we want to do is kind of shift that system, the systematic side of the clinics, and bringing that support. And what we're doing is approaching it now from the clinic side of 30 to 50% of people are dropping out of IVF treatment, often not because of money, because even with free cycles, they'll abandon those because it's so emotionally volatile and it's put such strain on the relationship. And people get to decision fatigue. I don't know what to do next. I just won't do anything. So we're trying to make it incumbent on clinics now to provide this support. And that's why we have this whole suite of supports. And I do really feel on a mission to make sure that this level of grief and aloneness for one in six couples isn't accepted anymore. And millennial ladies and Gen Z's coming behind them, they're going to stand up and look for it. So that's what we're trying to do here, yeah, with flowering fertility.
Well, look, I could talk longer, but sadly we are out of time. If people want to find out more information, they can go to floweringfertilitysupport.com. Claire Mansfield, I'm so glad we got to make it happen. Thank you so much for coming on. Coming up after the break, Janine Van Someren, performance expert on her book, The Wellbeing Advantage.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, Janine Van Someren came on the show a few years back when she invited me to try out the Wellbeing Advantage. She runs this with her fellow PhD husband. They are both experts in performance and have brought their knowledge to elite athletes, corporate leaders, and wanted to showcase what they do to anybody and everybody, because everybody deserves to be able to perform at their best. You wear a heart rate variability monitor for 48 hours, you keep a diary alongside it, and then you discuss the data collected and what it tells you. And I have to say, hands down, it was one of the most insightful things I have ever done. It gave me so much information about what drains me and what fuels me. And I still quote it all of the time to my friends and in my corporate talks. Janine has just poured all of this wisdom and knowledge into her first book, just released, called The Wellbeing Advantage. And she joins me in studio now. Janine, you're very welcome.
Oh, what a lovely introduction.
And as we said, this is our first time face to face. We've met Zoom face to Zoom face because you're based in Sligo. Yeah. But it's lovely to meet you in real life, as they say.
No, it's great to be here. Great to be here. And what a lovely introduction. And fills me with such joy, considering your vast experience in the world of well-being. And I know just how many of the well-being experts in Ireland and beyond you've met. So the fact that the work that we've done together has had an impact, really just, oh, I'm beaming here. So thanks for that.
And I gave you a review to write that you kindly asked me to write one for the book. And that's what I said. With this book, people can have this same knowledge in their hands. Yes. And it is out now. But before we get into the book, what does performance mean to you?
So performance to me is very much about how we live our lives. It's not about doing more. And that's a really big thing that I want to say, because people hear high performance and think, oh, that's not for me, that's for somebody else. But performance isn't about being exceptional. It's simply about balancing your energy and your capacity with really high quality recovery so that you can live the best life for you and what's needed for you. So it's that balance between energy and capacity and recovery.
And that's everybody. As I said, elite athletes, because that's what we think of when we think of performance, people who are beating their personal bests.
Yeah.
But a stay-at-home parent needs to be able to perform at their best. A student needs to be able to perform at their best. A labourer needs to perform at their best.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally everybody.
It is everybody. And it's about what's right for you at this time, because you're not Usain Bolt. As much as we, you know, think, oh gosh, I'm all into high performance and I've listened to all the podcasts, the reality is we've got to go with what's right for us. So it's all about tuning into really what matters to you and what's important for you today, what your capacity is like today. Because I'll have clients who are talking about what their life was like previously. Oh, I used to be able to do all of these things and now I'm no longer able to do that. And I'd be very much like, we start where we're at. We look at what our capacity is like today. Take a breath. Just build that awareness of where you're at today. Because very much well-being is an inside job, and it doesn't matter what you've read or how many podcasts you listen to. If you haven't developed the skill of really listening to yourself and where you're at today, then all of that knowledge, it really doesn't matter.
So the book sort of gets into wearable tech, getting the data about yourself, reflection on that, and then building small habits around that that will bring about the change that you were looking for. And it's really interesting. I have a funny relationship with wearable tech. And I would always have said, and I even wrote into my own book, that I'm not really into it, because I didn't want my watch to tell me I had a bad night's sleep, because I thought, well, I'm going to figure that out for myself.
Yeah.
But I didn't correlate the experience I had with you wearing the heart rate variability monitor and the insight it gave me, because I saw that as sort of standalone. So do you come up against that, this resistance to wearable tech, but the valuable insights it can give us?
Yeah, there's a huge amount of resistance. I would say the vast majority of my clients who come to me and already love the technology are what I would classify as the worried well. They really know a huge amount about themselves. They have all of the data and they really thrive on it. And really, they're coming to me to get that performance edge. So they're looking for that extra margin. They absolutely love it. But it can lead to data overload. They're too involved with what the data means. And they wake up and look at the data and see it as a score. Wearable data is not a score. You haven't done well or done badly. You haven't had a good day or a bad day. You want to look at it as a reflection of what's going on in my body right now. So I need to turn down the dial on the data for those clients of mine and really use the sort of information that I would do with a client like yourself, who's a bit like, oh my God, I could get really bogged down by these numbers and I find it quite heavy. And you know what? Life is busy enough. I don't need another score of how well I'm doing that day. And I really lean into that data is just awareness. That number is just giving us an insight into how your body is getting on at that point in time. And really, when I'm working with clients, I talk very little about numbers and more about patterns of change. So we get a baseline idea of where people are at the point in time that they start using a wearable. And that's what's really important. If you've bought a wearable this weekend, just get a baseline score. Don't wait for your best day. A lot of clients will say, oh, I don't want to start working with you until things are really good and then I can get really great scores. I would say just start where you're at. Get a baseline of what's normal for you. And then don't look at the data at all. Maybe once a week, look at it. And really, you're just tracking data. It is not about getting perfect scores. It is all about progress. Are you yourself feeling more energized? Are you feeling like you have capacity to do more of what fills you with joy and light? Whatever it is, whether it's work or home or your relationships, do you feel like you have more capacity for that? If you've been tuning into the data, if you've been realizing what the data is telling you. So if you have a day where suddenly your body battery score might say it's low, really think, gosh, what was going on for me yesterday that my body battery is low? What was I doing? Like, what did I get up to last night? When did I go to bed? Have I had a good night's sleep? And what's good for me? And begin to really tune into the data and the numbers are just information. Just use them as information, not a score of whether you're good or bad. Just use it as information. But crucially, and what the wearables don't do, is they don't ask the really curious questions that your coach might ask you with regards to, so Claire, what's been going on with you today? Like, why are you feeling like you don't have capacity and yet you're telling me your sleep score is really high? What else is going on? So really get in and be curious about what the data is telling you. Don't just rely on the number and think that's my score today. Really just think, what does that mean?
Yeah, because I think not only do you have the data from, say, the heart rate variability monitor, for example, yeah, the key information is actually the diary that goes alongside it. What were you doing in those moments that have shown you to be at rest, refueling, yeah, topping yourself back up? That's the key information more than the data. You have a really good quote at the start of the book in your foreword that really struck out to me. From a general practitioner, a GP, who is huge in lifestyle medicine. And he said, in this modern world, health doesn't just happen. It has to be consciously designed. And I that really struck me. It is true, isn't it? I think we're really hard on ourselves, particularly when it comes to our well-being. I'm not doing enough. Why am't I doing enough? But there is so much going on in modern life, yeah, that it is going to have to take care and attention. It's not just going to happen for us the way it might have previous generations.
Yeah, absolutely. We are bombarded on a daily, hourly basis with constant stimulation. So we're looking at email notifications, we're responding to not only information coming into us from our devices, but also we're taking on a lot of other people's challenges as well. So that to me is noise. And we live in a noisy world. And the noise I'm talking about there is stimulation. So we're overly stimulated and we've become addicted to this stimulation. And it's been well documented. You know, there's a great book called Dopamine Nation that talks about how we're addicted to getting that buzz when we respond to the noise. A lot of the work I do is about really leaning into my clients' life and helping them quieten the noise. And really looking at moments of calm in your day and very specific habits that you can do to break that cycle of noise. Because I can't remove your pain in the ass, boss, and I can't change the dynamic in your family that might be causing you a little bit of strife. But what I can absolutely do is assure you that with very simple, easy habits, you can quieten the noise. And if you get really good at it, Claire, you'll turn off that noise every now and then. But crucially, I notice the difference. And again, I see it in the data. I see it, you know, when you chat to clients, they feel better. And it's because that noise has been dialed down. So it's habits that help to regulate your nervous system, help to really give a strong trigger to your vagus nerve that I'm not in danger. Nothing bad is going to happen to me if I don't respond to that email immediately. I can take a breath. I can pause. And honestly, if you can manage to figure out the habits that allow you to turn down the noise, it will transform your life because all of a sudden you're not so responsive to things. Instead of reacting to things, you're responding to things in a really calm and regulated way. And the ripple effect of that on your colleagues, your co-workers, your friends, your kids is transformative.
And people might be listening and think, oh, yeah, well, you know, Claire, you learned all this information, but you work in wellness. You're different. But what really I learned that I retell to people was that it wasn't big, major heading off to retreats and hanging out with monks that was really making the difference to me. And to be able to see in, I say black and white, but it's actually red to green. We're never going to remove stress from our lives. So red on the graph shows up as being on the go, driving, commuting, cooking, working, might be the odd spike when you hit traffic or let a roar at the kids. That's all normal. It was the swathes of green that I saw on my graph. And you would say to me, what were you doing in these green moments? And yes, there was the morning getting back into bed and doing the meditation for 10 minutes. That was perhaps something that would fall under the stereotype, if you will, of wellness. But the surprising ones were dozing in front of absolute bubblegum TV that I would have assumed was a waste of time, getting my nails done and being in flow working at my computer. We give out to everybody about spending too much time. But if you're doing something you love, that can be topping you up. And to be able to take yourself from red to green with ease. And as you say, no, the walk with the dog tops me up. Watching a little bit of trash TV tops me up. And another line, I'm going to choose one from you now rather than the foreword. I think it's only right, seeing as it is your book, was rest isn't time away from performance. It's part of performance. And that's something I don't think we understand. We don't celebrate rest, do we?
We really don't celebrate rest. And in this sort of world of always being on, and very much we're feeling like people feel guilty for stopping. And I do think the Irish with our, you know, get up and go attitude, which is absolutely fantastic. But you look at any Irish woman on a sunny day and they're absolutely bananas with all the things they need to get done because the sun is out. The laundry has to get on. They have to get out and get a picnic for the kids. They have to head down to the beach. They have to go. I mean, people are just on all the time and they don't realise that you cannot, it's unsustainable. So being on all the time is completely unsustainable. And any time that you feel like you've had a full-on day, if you've sat down on the sofa and gone, oh my God, this day has been absolutely manic, I need to just pause. Have a really good think about what you turn on the television that night. Really think about what will help me completely calm down. So it's not something crazy like the pit, which loads of people are chatting about at the moment, or it's not some sort of psychological drama. Really think about, I need to balance the busyness of my day with rest. And while I might not be that Buddhist monk who's going to meditate, definitely, if you put your phone away, ideally in another room, but just put it away and really think about how you're going to regulate your nervous system. And one way can be your choice of what you put on television. It can be that choice of specifically looking at anything that allows your heart rate to lower in a very calm and measured way. And clients really notice the difference with that. So it's not about meditation and being a Buddhist monk. It is about finding ways in your day that you can find rest and recovery. And ideally, I would say to people, try and find something at the start and end of your day. Really think about how you're going to bookend your day. I talk about it with regards to building a moat. So if you're commuting to work, try and make your commute as calm as you can. So radio on a little bit lower than usual, choosing carefully what it is that you're listening to. And at the end of the day, maybe even just going home in silence or choosing what type of book that you read, that it's something that's regulating. But bookend your day, the start and end, with something that helps to regulate your nervous system. Just feel calm.
And all of that knowledge and wisdom is in this book. It goes through all the different habits understanding yourself. Janine, you share your own personal story and lots of case studies. I can't recommend it enough. It is in bookshops now. It's called The Wellbeing Advantage. And if you want to find out more about Janine's work, you can go to thewellbeingadvantage.com. Janine Van Someren, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Claire.
So that's it for Live and Kicking for this week. My thanks to all my guests, to my producer Aoife Breen and to Hugo De Silva Scott, who was on sound. Rory Galvin was on podcasts. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.